Welcome to Sneaking in the Movies. My name is Speed, and this is my homeboy, Tyrone. And we are like movie critics and shit.
And welcome to round two, or episode two, of the V-Cinema Podcast. We're back here again to reinfest your ears with some cult film madness.
Yes, sir, we are.
Yes, and my name's Coffin John. I'm from the V-Cinema Podcast and Webcast. And of course, I have my co-host here, that's Josh. So, Josh, how's it going today?
Just feel me breathing on. And you know I mean business when it comes to fucking.
Whoa, Tiger, slow it down.
I'm not gonna piss on your head, your hair and all. Just gonna piss in the toilet.
How you doing, Josh?
Oh, man. Great. Awesome.
So we're on our second show. I'm sure we've gotten enough feedback from our first show. Would you say so?
Yeah. We've been hyping that up a couple weeks now, yep. I guess.
So, speaking of which, since this is the second show, you know that when, for example, bands or even directors put out the sequels to movies, of course, there's that fear of the sophomore slump. We hope that's not the case, do we?
It is. This is all downhill.
Yeah,
from here.
I can imagine.
Pretty much. Yeah. First episode was the peak. And, you know, if you didn't like that, then this week's just going to be that much
worse.
I'm just going down. It's just a matter of time until we're all
wow, it's already getting worse.
Put them on ice.
Wow. Anyway.
I'm dancing.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, well, you know who that was?
I have no idea.
Oh, that was Fallout Boy.
See,
I heard the Utes of America are into the Fallout Boy. I thought we could get more downloads with that.
Oh yeah, I'm officially mid 20s though, so I'm like an old man already. So
You're much closer to being a teenager than me. In fact, I would say the differences in our age is you could put a teenager between us.
There could be a young boy. hold for editing. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay.
No, I'm not editing that. So anyway, so this show, we've got some good stuff for you. Actually, you know, the first show was very well structured, so we're just going to be following basically what we did in the first show. Mm-hmm. We have, of course, a movie review for you. We have, Takashi Miike's 1995 film, Shinjuku Triad Society. We also have The Block. Boom, boom, boom. That's, of course, our Netflix instant watch segment. Show and tell, and of course a Twitter question, which we put out just yesterday, in fact.
Yeah, right? Earlier this week or something.
Right. And then we also have a segment last show, I shouldn't say last show, but the first show, we sort of had just a introduce yourself type of segment, but we have a new segment that's going to be coming up. It's going to be a discussion question. And with this discussion question, of course, we're going to talk about our own feelings about particular issues regarding film, etc. And we do encourage all of you guys, all of you listeners, to write in or call in. We do have a voicemail number. We'll announce that in a little bit. And, of course, voice your own opinions and such.
And get to it.
Yes. Anyway, so let's
looking at TSF. I'm looking at him right now, man.
Oh,
suffering fanboy.
Well,
my fingers on the ban button right now, buddy.
Right. Actually, you know what? I just don't want to look at him. This is what my feeling is towards him.
Yeah, fuck you too.
Anyway, so tell me, Josh. Let's go into what we've been doing. So, what have you been watching? You know, reading, playing, or
man, so much. So much since the past 2 weeks. I just checked out a book yesterday from the library on Alfred Hitchcock.
Whoa,
I haven't really
books.
Got to read it, but yeah. I ain't going to read it either. I'm just going to end up probably reading about 30 pages and then giving up and then having a late fee.
Okay.
But aside from that, movies I've been watching. First thing I got listed here, Crime Story. the Jackie Chan movie.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's like one of his more serious roles, less stunts, more melodrama kind of thing. I remember telling you that I wasn't digging it when I first started watching it, but it actually gets a lot better as it goes along. Mm. So that was actually a pretty good little flick. It's got a lot of really good suspense, especially in the third half. Mm. And then I watched, Lost in La Mancha, the Gilliam film.
Oh, yes, right.
Never seen that before. I mean, I'd seen pieces of it before, I think on like IFC or something. I liked that.
Is that a typical sort of Gilliam film?
No, it's a documentary about a movie that he was making, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
Oh, right.
And basically the movie went into production, I forget how many weeks of pre-production there were, and then like maybe a week worth of actual shooting before, you know, a storm came along, destroyed sets. One of the lead star who was playing Don Quixote was injured, broke his back, and couldn't continue. And basically it's a movie about a failure.
That sounds very much like the Apocalypse Now documentary. Have you seen that one, yeah. Hearts of Darkness?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's similar to it, less darkness, but equally as failure-ridden kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
What else did I watch? I watched a lot of Mystery Science Theater this past week. I watched A Garden Without Birds. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
It's a Japanese short. It's like 20-something minutes, 23, 27 minutes or whatever. Really, I don't know, it's just really messed up. It's about the extent of it. It's about an orgy that goes wrong. Like six people, I think, get together in a hotel room looking to do some S&M, and then things go bad. They take some drugs, and people start dying.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, all kinds of nastiness.
Wow,
tongues bitten off, blood, gore. Kind of like your basic underground Japanese gore stuff, kind of like Muzan E and Tumbling Doll of Flesh and stuff like that.
I see. It's only 20 minutes?
Yeah, it's only 23, 27 minutes. It's not as extreme as those movies, but, you know, if you're into that sort of thing, it's an interesting watch. Watched Brazil for the first time.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Gilliam. That was amazing. Mm-hmm. Blew my mind.
Yeah, I saw that you were discussing that with Emily, also known as Deadly Dolls.
Yes. She is not a fan.
Oh, okay.
Yes, she's not a fan, but it's really amazing. She said she understands it and respects it, but basically if she had to watch it again, she'd, you know, jab a pin in her eye kind of thing. But I thought it was a lot better than that. I thought it's like a visually amazing film, just amazing what the man does with like depth and color. Almost every shot, it's kind of like almost like a Tsukamoto film where you watch it and you're bombarded with new kind of imagery, stuff you haven't seen before.
Right.
And it really just is like, whoa. And then you have a really interesting story to go with it. So to me, you know, I forget how long it was. It's a fairly long film, but it breezed by for me. I watched Hanging Chads. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
It's a Italian documentary about Italian horror during the 80s. I wasn't too blown away with it, truthfully. They talk more about 80s stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So there's talk about Fulci gets brought up, and Argento gets brought up, and Michael Suave gets brought up. But I don't know, the movies they choose to talk about. For Argento, they're talking about Phenomena, and then they're talking about Demons with Bava, and Stage Fright, Della Morte, Della More, but they don't go into the 70s or really some of the, you know, even better of, you know, Fulci stuff. I don't know. I just felt like they didn't capture everything that they probably should have.
Yeah, that seems kind of odd that they would focus on the 80s, you said, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
as things were winding down.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, unless there was some kind of, you know, overall, you know, theme that they were trying to go for, like, you know, like you said, the winding down period of that, you know, that particular genre.
I don't know. They just missed. I mean, they didn't really go in. They have so many different areas that are interesting from, you know, 60s, 70s Italian cinema that just pretty much get bypassed. And they start talking about how great the 80s were.
Which, that's funny.
You know, It's true for, like, the American slasher film, but for me, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in the 70s that they passed up, and a lot of great films even in the 80s that they just didn't cover.
Right.
Also watched Fitzcarraldo from Werner Herzog.
Right, Herzog, yeah. Well,
yeah, she's... That was really great.
Oh, yes, yeah. It's a great film.
Yeah, classic. It's probably my third or fourth of his films. And, Klaus Kinski, man. He's brilliant.
Yeah, that guy can really, like, portray madness like no other, I think.
That's because it hits so close to home.
I think maybe only second to like John Malkovich or something.
Have you seen My Best Fiend from Herzog?
I don't think I have seen that. No.
Oh my gosh, you gotta see it! It's on Netflix Instant. It's basically Werner Herzog, a documentary by him about how completely and utterly insane Klaus Kinski was. It really is. They have all kinds of like great footage of him on set just going nuts. Wow. Just like flipping out on people over nothing.
Wow.
And you know, pretty much hoping that, you know, Herzog dies. And it's like, yeah, it's like an hour and a half of just him going bonkers.
Wow.
It's freaking great.
I'll have to add that to my queue then.
Yeah. I watched another, I watched Burden of Dreams, which is tied in with Fitzcarraldo, which is about, you know, the 4-year production of Fitzcarraldo and about them having, you know, if you've ever seen Fitzcarraldo, you know that they take a 30 or 60 ton boat.
Oh, yes.
From one river over, you know, instead of land and into another, you know, river. And basically, even though the story that's based around the original guy, he didn't actually do that. You know, he didn't actually, he had a much smaller boat that they took apart and, you know, carried the pieces and then built it in the other river. But Herzog just had this vision in his mind that he had to do it for real. So, you know, it's all about that and about how dangerous it was on set and pretty much how Herzog himself's got a little bit of, you know, craziness to him.
Right.
But, you know, both are brilliant, you know, despite how, you know, a little bit kooky they are, you know what I'm saying?
Right. So that kind of almost ties in with the Gilliam documentary, right? Or
it
the
does,
Hearts
yeah.
of Darkness, right?
Yeah. Been a couple of weeks worth of documentaries. And my next film on here is another documentary, Africa Audio.
Oh, yes.
Or Africa Blood and Guts,
right,
as it was called in America. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it, but it's been such a long time. I don't remember much about it.
Yeah, I liked it. I was really surprised that I liked it, too, because the first 20 or 30 minutes of it, it's about a two-hour film, something like that. The first 30 minutes of it's kind of, I don't know, just a really, really slow burn. You're just like, yeah, okay, you know, I mean, ooh, all right, you know. Wow, Africa's pretty. But then after it, by the time it gets to like the 20 minute, I'd say 20 minutes, probably only like 5 or 6, but there's this montage of animals being just killed, you know?
Right.
Being shot with arrows.
Oh, yes, I remember that part. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When it, by the time you get to that, you're like, whoa, what just happened?
Right.
And then the movie just takes a much darker and disturbing turn, you know?
Right.
And it goes into the, you know, for those who haven't seen it, it goes into the war in Africa, and there's a lot of really just, you know, pretty amazing footage that the filmmakers were able to catch. Yeah, I'm not going to give too much credit to Shaka Petty. I forget, do you know the two filmmakers?
I can't remember offhand.
I know one of Shaka Petty. And,
you know, of course, you know, we're always so... like every other podcast, we're so, you know, up on our trivia and our research as well. But let me give it a quick look while...
Yeah, I'll keep talking.
Stomp.
But I don't know if they are the most up-and-up kind of guys. I get the feeling while watching some of their films, like, that they take things and do the... Maybe I wouldn't even be surprised if some of the things that happen are instigated by them. You know?
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, that's always been a criticism against the, you know, so-called Mondo films, is that, you know, how much of it is, you know, real and how much of it is really staged. And, of course, yeah. You know, what the documentary, I'm using air quotes right now, that really, you know, emphasizes that kind of problem is, you know, Faces of Death.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, the filmmakers were Franco Prosperi and Galtiero Giacopetti. Yeah.
Yes. A new added last name. Yes. Yeah, it's definitely, it's an interesting film, and if you can handle the content, it's, I mean, I was actually kind of blown away with it. I was really surprised at the quality of it, because it's not all just blood and guts, even though that's what it was retitled to. And the filmmakers are probably, they probably were a little more than, you know, insensitive to the subject matter, especially due to being in Africa, but, I don't know, it's just a really interesting watch. You just sit there and just blown away by it, like, wow, really?
Right,
you
know?
Yeah. I watched Time After Time. That's probably the last one I made a note of. But yeah, I watched Time After Time, which you recommended last week.
Right.
You were right. It was awesome.
Of course.
Yes. What'd you say, honky sucker pig head, jive turkey fool?
Okay, so I guess it's my turn.
Yes, sir.
So, actually, I like I said last episode, I've been so concerned with getting ready for school, and school did start yesterday. Last night was my first class, and it was, but, you know, in my free time, I was able to check out a couple of things, and, you know, while you seem to be on sort of a documentary tier right now, I'm very much kind of in the commercial film tier. I'm in the mainstream tier right
now. Whoa.
I didn't get to watch a lot, but I did get to watch Up and District 9.
Really?
Yeah, have you seen either of those?
I have seen District 9. I have not seen Up.
You have not seen Up. Okay. Yeah, I kind of remember last episode you said that you're not much of a Pixar person, or?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, you know, there's a little message I got for you.
You make me watch Japanese porn. I'm making you watch this Pixar film. I don't care what you say.
Yeah, I would really recommend.
It was only once I did that. Okay. Come on, man.
I would really recommend checking out Up if there's any Pixar film that you'd want to. I know that other people have their own personal favorites. But I think Up, one thing is the animation is, the characters are very simple characters, you know. I mean, you know, they're just, it's a boy and an older man and animals, et cetera. Yeah, I know, this sounds kind of scary.
Oh, this is,
back to the Japanese porn. But the way that they're animated is so fluid looking and natural, even though it's, you know, obviously a cartoon, and it's kind of, you know, it's got its wacky moments at that. You know, everything feels very real, or at least very organic. And you know, I thought especially the animals in the film, they're, you know, there's like this pack of dogs, there's, and they can all talk basically, and there's also a very large bird. Yeah, this sounds like a really interesting an old man, a boy, a large bird.
There's a giraffe in there.
But
talking monkey.
But they're all animated really well. The animals are very cute. It's sort of a movie that's, a lot of people I think will tell you that it's a very touching movie. It didn't touch me. It didn't touch me.
You had to take the children's movie.
Oh my
movie
God, you're totally destroying this, okay? But it didn't really, I didn't feel it. I didn't feel it as, I think, as much as other people did. There are a couple very touching sequences. There's one sequence where it shows the older character, how he, as a boy, met his future wife, and, you know, basically their life together. And it's a very quick sequence, like about a minute and 30 seconds.
Is that the first 10 minutes I keep hearing
about? Right.
That's what I keep hearing about.
Right, and that part's very very sweet, very touching. But I thought the rest of it was kind of, it was cute, and, you know, there's that message of keeping promises, you know, going forth and doing living your dreams, you know, that kind of thing. But I thought, you know, I don't want to say that the messages were given very tritely, but they weren't. I thought, you know, for kids it might be good, but for adults, I kind of wanted something a little stronger to go on. Because, you know, if you balance that with the wackiness of the film itself, it felt a little uneven, I guess I should say.
I'll have to check it out sometime. Maybe if it hits Netflix Instant or something.
Oh, yeah.
Probably be easy for me to check out.
And then District 9, I thought, was it was also a little slightly disappointing. I think there are a lot of people who really like it. I thought...
I do.
Oh, you did?
I love it.
Okay. I thought it was pretty good. It was kind of like, to me, I mean, I posted a review on Facebook, you know, to my personal friends, and I just basically said it was E.T. meets Aliens and throw a little splatter in there. And
yeah.
You know, and I like the narrative drive was very good. I mean, it was very pacey, which was nice. You know, the splatter was very good. The effects were excellent. The only thing I did not like very much was the editing. There was way too much. It was way too frenetic and too much cutting.
I can see that.
Definitely. Yeah, it sort of, in a way, it sort of gave me a headache. It was a little noisy too. Maybe I sound like an old man by saying this. I know, but you know, it just felt kind of, you know, like, oh my god.
This movie's too scary. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. Did I pee my pants?
Josh? But no, I can see that. I'm definitely not a fan of MTV editing or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
So, I definitely saw that in it. But I had a good enough time with it, you know, where it didn't bother me so
right.
much.
Yeah. And another thing is, well, lately I've been in sort of a, I guess I should say, retrospective, introspective type of mood. And as far as what I've been reading, I've been reading this book called American Hardcore. It's by this journalist. His name is Stephen Blush. It's a book that was actually made into, I don't want to say made into a movie, but... the movie was inspired by the book, I guess you could say. But anyway, so it's a documentary. The movie's a documentary on the hardcore scene, how the punk rock scene sort of gave birth to the hardcore scene of the early 80s. The book is written by Stephen Blush. Again, he's a journalist. He's written for Spin Magazine and The Village Voice, among other magazines and periodicals, but again, it's documenting the hardcore scene of the early 80s, which I was sort of a part of. That's how I got my start into punk rock, because basically the hardcore scene was born from the suburbs of especially the West Coast, whereas punk rock came more from the East Coast. Right, exactly. You know, I've been reading about a lot of my old heroes, old musical heroes, I guess I should say, you know, such as the Bad Brains and Black Flag. And I've been sort of thinking about, you know, like, I guess the reason why I started reading the book was to sort of get a feeling for how I've developed my tastes and interests through time. So, you know, why would I want to get into, you know, hardcore music when I was just this, you know, suburban kid who was, you know, doing okay in school, and you know, I was just about your average everyday kid. You know, why would that sort of person such as me get into punk rock and hardcore? And that's kind of reflected in our discussion question that's coming up a little later, which is, you know, basically why do we watch cult film? So, you know, I think that question came out of this sort of feeling of, you know, why am I the way I am? You know, I guess that happens when you get older, you know, and you have little boys and animals around you. Like,
oh yeah, yeah, definitely. I can definitely get with that. You know,
right.
So the film, the documentary, was it also directed? Is it the same title?
Yeah, the documentary goes by the same title. It's American Hardcore. It's directed by Paul Rackman.
I've heard. You know what? I think I've heard of that. I had sat there, and my uncle, who he's into more punk and metal than I am, he had me procure the soundtrack, I believe.
Oh, okay.
I think he caught it on IFC one night or something.
Oh, okay, yeah. It's got a really good soundtrack. And it's got actually it features a couple of shows or concerts, if you're not... But it features a couple of shows that actually I was at, so that was kind of cool, too.
Snap.
I mean, you can't see me, but I know I was at those particular shows.
You're up in the front.
Yeah, stage.
Right, with the guy singing on the microphone with
yeah,
him.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, do we have anything else to talk about before we go into our discussion segment?
That should be it.
Okay, well, we got a little music for you until we get to that segment, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes.
What's up, everybody? This is Bill.
And this is Chris.
From Outside the Cinema. We're here to give you the reasons why you should be listening to Outside the Cinema. One, we cover kick-ass movies.
Two, we cover kick-ass movies.
Okay, this isn't going to work if you continue this way.
Oh, really? I'm not supposed to echo what you say?
Three, I'm good-looking.
Four, I would agree with that.
And five, your life pretty much depends on it.
This is Kane Hodder. Keep listening to Outside the Cinema, or I'll kill you.
OutsideTheCinema.com. It's on the fucking internet.
Outside the Cinema, your source for cult movie discussion.
Hey, welcome back. Hope you enjoy the music. That was something actually I did myself. That's one of the loops that I did back in college. I used to do music a lot, and I still have a lot of my old files, so I wanted to be able to use them on the show here. Speaking of which, we could always use contributions from you musicians who have your own little personal projects. So if you have anything that you want to send to us, let us know. Email us at vcinema@variedcelluloid.net. You can also email us even more simply at vcinema@yahoo.com. It goes to the same place. Anyway, this segment of the show, we're going to do a discussion question. And the discussion question is kind of meant to talk about topics in cult film and genre film. And to hopefully get you guys to participate, of course, you'd want to email us, vcinema@variedcelluloid.net. We also have voicemail that you can call us at. Our voicemail number is 206-338-3864.
Yes.
Yeah, that's that's the same voicemail service that the other podcasters use. So make sure not to mix them up. I don't want mail from GGTMC or anything, you know, talking about you know, men's pecs and stuff like that. Yeah, Randy Spears or whatever. <you know. laughs> Anyway, so today's or I should say this episode's question of the show is going to be, why do we watch cult film? Because, you know, there are, of course, a lot of mainstream stuff, you know, that we could watch. And, you know, of course, all of our friends and family watch. And here we're kind of in this little cult film sort of niche. And, you know, why would we want to be in this niche? So tell me, Josh, you were probably, I gave you a couple days to think about this question. What did you come up with? Why do you watch cult film?
Well, the definition of cult film for me is pretty, you know, it's pretty expansive. I don't think, you know, a cult film is really tied to any particular genre or anything like that. So for me, when you say cult film, you know, it's basically any film that is, just a smaller film that has a niche audience or an audience that is, you know, highly devoted or, you know, just a smaller audience that's, you know, way more into the film than what you would get on a more mainstream level.
True.
So, yeah, so that's, to me, what cult film is. And for me, it was just basically, you know, you move to that out of necessity kind of thing after you're kind of done with your average mainstream material, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
I was talking to you. I didn't mention it in the movies that I watched this past couple of weeks, but I talked to you about it on the forum. I think I had went and seen, what was that, a couple of days ago or something like that. I'd went and seen Sherlock Holmes because somebody, you know, gave me money and said, hey, go see a movie. So, right. Yeah. I didn't really want to contribute to Avatar since it's so huge already. So I was like, I'll go see, you know, this Guy Ritchie movie. So went and seen it, but it was all right. You know, it was a good, you know, time waster kind of thing. But Hollywood film in general is kind of all like that, where at this point it's like I watch these movies and afterward I almost feel, you know, empty. You know, it's like it was like an hour and a half worth of, you know, hey man, did you see what we just did? That was freaking cool, right? Right. And I'm just like, yeah, that's really neat, but you know, what's the point?
Right.
And you know, going to cult film, and which can be anything almost, can be, you know, French New Wave, or it can be, you know, Japanese gore, or it can be, you know, Hong Kong heroic bloodshed movies or whatever. It's like pretty much the same thing all these movies have in common are that, you know, they offer something unique. They offer something different from the norm.
Right.
Something that you're not going to see when you go and see a Michael Bay movie or whatever. It's new ideas and it's fresh content. Even though you're watching something from maybe, you know, the 1940s or 30s, it's still something you don't see anymore.
Right.
And it might not even have been something popular back in its heyday, but it was made by someone who wanted to try new things. And, you know, that to me is the definition of cult film and really what makes it so special.
Right. Kind of like.
That's my thoughts on that.
Okay. Okay, well, I have slightly different thoughts, because I think when you think of cult film, and we use the word cult film and genre film interchangeably a lot of the times, I do so myself. Actually, I think that's not quite correct in terms of, because cult film, genre film to me is just anything genre that has a particular genre, right? I mean, it could be mainstream, and it could very well be you know, underground. Cult film actually has somewhat of the same differentiation, because when you think of it, for example, a movie like Heathers, I mean, Heathers was actually a mainstream film, but I would say it has much more of a cult following than it does a mainstream following, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was made within the environment, but that necessarily, that's what I'm talking about. It's just a new idea, and like I was saying, like ideas that might not have been proper at the time, or might not have caught on at the time, or been accepted at the time, but there is a select audience.
What'd you say, honky sucker, pig head, jive turkey fool?
So anyway, yeah.
Damn it, where's Mr. T?
So I think there is a slight difference between cult film and genre film, and I would say, you know, as far as the terminology goes, you know, even during the first episode, I mentioned that my parents are big genre fans. But I can't say that they are big cult fans, because, you know, they do like the shoot 'em ups and they like the martial arts films, but they don't necessarily care if a small little audience enjoys them. So that's where I see there's a difference between those two terms. And I think the big difference is, if I look at people like you, me, and let's say a lot of our audience, or probably all of our audience, you know, for example, the other podcasters and the other bloggers who we associate ourselves with, in a way, and I, you know, of course I'm not saying this in a critical manner, but in a way, I see a lot of us being outside of being movie fans, a lot of us being sort of outsiders by nature. You know, I was thinking about this, you know, as I was, you know, like I talked about in the last segment, I was talking about my older days with punk rock, etc. And I was thinking about in terms of, you know, why would I take this path of being, you know, a punk rocker as opposed to, let's say, an accountant or a computer programmer? Because, you know, I am, for example, Asian American, and that's, you know, those are the things that...
Good at math.
Right, exactly. Those are things that Asian Americans are both, you know, stereotyped and sort of, and also aspire to be. And, you know, why would I take this direction? And I think part of it is because it's a personal... I don't want to say it's a personal choice as in like, okay, I'm going to be a cult film enthusiast. But I think once you sort of understand yourself as being outside of the mainstream, like in the sense of, you know, oh, you know, I'm into punk rock or I'm into metal or I have these different feelings from other people. You know, like, for example, I have a lot of cult film friends who like cult film, excuse me, who are, for example, homosexual. And I ask them, you know, well, do you think the two, you know, relate to each other? And, you know, I asked a friend of mine this, in fact, just this past week, you know, along the same theme. And, you know, he thought about it really closely and he thought, you know, I think there is some kind of connection because you see yourself as an outsider. So you tend to sort of latch on to things that make you an outsider. So, yeah. You know, a lot of cult film fans are into punk and metal and industrial, sort of these fringe types of musics. And I think it's sort of natural for us to sort of get into other fringe types of things. And, you know, whether that be, you know, things like drugs, you know, for better or worse, for worse, probably, I guess you could
say, yeah,
you know, without passing any kind of, you know, moral judgment.
Judgment.
But, you know, things like movies and things like, you know, there's, of course, alt literature, you know, all these kinds of things that help define that we are not the mainstream. We are not you or we are not your parents, that kind of thing. I think that sort of thing, you know, those kinds of ideas sort of breed themselves. You know, that if you're going to get into one, you're more likely to get into another. So if you're, in this case, let's say, if you're likely to get into metal, you're more likely to get into horror movies, for example.
Yeah.
And if I look at my own past, I think that plays out very well because, for example, you know, I got into punk when I was in, like around the seventh or sixth grade. And that's around the same time I started getting more into horror movies and being more of a fanatic as far as, you know, collecting movies and things like that. And I think I could see as being, you know, why I got into cult film was because it was just another thing to help define me as being different from my peers and my parents and in identifying with this new world. You know, when you're young, you want to sort of carve out your own little niche and say, you know, look, I'm an individual. I can, you know, I don't need my parents to be, you know, who I am. And, you know, I definitely think that was a big part of it. Yeah.
I feel what you're saying there, dog. I feel you. I think
group hug.
Come on, man. No, I think there's definitely that rebellion type of thing that goes into it for sure. You know, and it is. It's a slippery slope with pretty much almost anything. Like, you know, horror movies might lead to kung fu movies. Kung fu movies lead to Asian cinema, and that's kind of what happened with me,
right?
In that regard, and then Asian cinema led to, you know, French cinema, and then et cetera, you know. It starts in one direction, and before long, you're buried in useless trivia.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's definitely why they would call us, you know, film geeks or film nerds. You know, I mean, a nerd. By definition, you know, the nerds, how can I say it, the nerds' currency or their way of trading is usually information, and it's usually very obscure.
Yes.
Information. You know, such and such person directed this movie, and he also directed this movie back in the 70s, blah, blah, blah. You know, that kind of obscure trivia.
It really is a thirst for knowledge, you know?
Yeah.
Even if, like, the information isn't particularly helpful in a lot of different ways, but it is, you know, once you see one thing or once you gain one bit of knowledge, you start looking in other directions, you know,
right,
and start exploring other facets of different genres and stuff like that. But yeah, you know, what starts it all out, yeah, I mean, you could say that, you could say, you know, rebellion or a hunger to be different, you know.
Yeah. Mhm. I would think so. I mean, that's like I said, that's a big part of how we identify ourselves is, you know, by our interests, mm-hmm. You know. If you look
that's
at...
That's why we wear the t-shirts.
Right, exactly. If you look at, for example, like recently I've been looking at, you know, networking sites, you know, personal networking sites, you know, like Facebook or whatever. And, you know, I've been looking at trends as to how people identify themselves. And, you know, it's usually by interests, of course, your job, of course, and products that you buy. You know, I got a new iPhone, you know, that kind of thing.
iPad, man.
Right. So those kinds of things, I think, are the ones that help us define ourselves. And then by moving over to a cult film, then we kind of want to even, you know, with more granularity, define ourselves within a group. So, you know, I might say I like martial arts, and someone else might say I like martial arts too. You know, they might be talking about, for example, I don't know, Enter the Dragon, but I might be talking about, for example, you know, some obscure Shaw Brothers movie. So there's a great difference between those two people because of, mm-hmm. you know, by granularity, what they're interested in.
Yeah, going back to the, you know, even you were talking about with genre versus cult film. And, genre is kind of like, you know, like when you meet a girl and she says, I like horror movies, your first instinct isn't that she's like talking about Bruno Mattei and Lucio Fulci. You know, you know she's talking about, I went and seen, you know, so-and-so at the movies and it was great or whatever. But, yeah, there's just definitely a different culture kind of thing.
Right.
Even though we use genre film to describe these other movies and stuff like that, or even the more underground or obscure stuff, it's still a much more, you know, a word that's much more open to interpretation.
Yeah, but even within the situation that you talked about right now with, mm-hmm. you know, you said if you meet someone who happens to say they like horror movies, you know, naturally we might mm-hmm. just expect that they're talking about Hostel or the Friday the 13th remake. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the same sense, I mean, look at how, like, for example, right, you never know, maybe that person will say right off the bat, you know, you know, I like Pulse, the Japanese version.
Yeah.
And then suddenly this whole world opens up, you know, which is what's kind of interesting about us cult film fans, I think, is that, you know, you can say, like, oh, I like horror, you know, I liked, you know, The Orphan, for example. And then automatically you're just like, oh, okay, mainstream horror. But, you know, if that person continues and says, I like the horror plus Children of the Corn, you might suddenly open up to them.
Oh,
or you might kill them, too. I'm not too sure.
Hey, man, I'd be totally awesome to meet someone who talks about Children of the Corn.
Okay, anyway. Okay. Well, let's leave it open to the listeners then. Again, you can email us at vcinema@variedcelluloid.net. A little more simply, vcinema@yahoo.com will also work. Also, leave us voicemail, 206-338-3864. Let us know what you think about this particular topic. Or, of course, if you want to suggest any other topics, you know, we're always open to maybe putting those into future shows. Okay?
Yes, sir. Yep.
Okay, well, why don't we take another short break here and go into our review after that. We're reviewing Takashi Miike's Shinjuku Triad Society.
Oh, boy.
Yes, so we'll be back.
Gay sex coming up.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, talking about it more than anything. I mean, I'm not playing.
What'd you say, honky sucker, pig head, jive turkey fool?
We'll be back in a couple seconds.
We'll tear your soul apart.
Some people lose their faith because heaven shows them too little. But how many people lose their faith because heaven shows them too much?
You'll never grow old, Michael. And you'll never die. But you must be.
Clatu Verata.
Maybe daily kicking balls or something.
Hey,
like
that's
that.
Cool, man.
So holy damn, but I've got gingivitis.
It's kind of like a vampire boner.
I would kill to be a tight leather suit.
Everything you've ever learned about freestyle orifice probing, you learned from me.
Oh, this definitely gets an all time.
For more information, visit cadaverlab.com or search for us on iTunes.
Welcome back. That's music from the movie that we're going to be reviewing this episode. We are reviewing 1995's Shinjuku Kuroshakai China Mafia Senso, also known as the Shinjuku Triad Society, directed by Takashi Miike and starring Kipe Shina, Tamaro Taguchi, Caesar Takeshi, as well as a special cameo performance by someone we'll mention in the review. Okay, well, why don't you just go ahead and launch into your synopsis, and then we'll talk about the movie.
Okay. Basically, Shinjuku Triad Society focuses on a cop named Tetsuhito, played by Kipe Shina. He's a half-Japanese, half-Chinese detective who follows in the Dirty Harry type of film character. He does things his own way. He, you know, doesn't listen to authority, doesn't like authority, and generally does some pretty unlawful things along the way. So he and his, you know, and the police, they find a decapitated body in front or in the alleyway near a club at the beginning of the film. They sit there and they do a raid on the club, knowing that it's a known triad place. They find a couple of characters who they seem to think knows more than they're letting on. So after they take them and do some pretty heavy torture on them, he gets the information and finds out about this half, I believe he's half Japanese, half Chinese too, isn't he, Wong?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's a half Japanese, half Chinese gangster triad. He's come to Japan and he's dealing in some pretty sordid stuff. He's selling organs on the black market, basically. Gets them from China, imports them over. While this is going on, Tetsuhito, his little brother, is also a lawyer, or he's a lawyer's assistant right at the moment, and he's working underneath his lover, this other man. And so the Tetsuhito's little brother, he's dealing with Wong and the triads. So he's getting involved not just as a lawyer, but also as a criminal. And that's what Tetsuhito fears, because his, you know, family has come to China, and they're his only loved ones. They're his only, the only thing he cares about in Japan, basically, because being from China, he's looked at as being different, and he has no home, whether in China or whether in Japan, due to his mixed nationality. So he's a man without a home, and the only thing that feels like home to him is his own family. He is out to save his brother, and Wong is out to just do some pretty nefarious things, and the two are on a collision course towards one another.
Okay, good. So what'd you think of the movie then?
It's one of my favorites.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite films from Takashi Miike, and generally just a favorite film of mine. Pretty kind of an odd one, because I know most people, when they think of Takashi Miike, they go for, you know, Audition or the more popular ones, or if they think of even the Black Society trilogy, they go for Ley Lines or Rainy Dog.
Right.
Both are great films in their own right, but I don't know. I discovered Shinjuku Triad Society. I watched the films in order originally, picked them up off of eBay years ago, back when, like, they called it, they didn't call it the Black Society trilogy. They called it the Shinjuku Triad Society trilogy when I bought it, like, through most places. And it was Shinjuku Triad Society, China Mafia War was on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially probably one of the most, I guess, disturbing would be one of the words to describe, one of the more disturbing, you know, police procedural movies that you're gonna ever really run across. Because it takes, you know, if you're familiar with Takashi Miike, you know he does some pretty, you know, outlandish movies than he does his more, you know,
sure,
toned down movies. So I don't want people to think that, you know, even though they're probably more familiar with this Mike, I don't want people to think that, you know, he's just a director that only does crazy stuff. But when he does do crazy stuff, it's pretty out there, and Shinjuku Dryad Society is kind of like the testimony to that fact.
Okay, well, without giving away too much of the story, without spoiling the movie, you know, what are some examples of this disturbingness that you're talking about?
Yeah, Shinjuku Dryad Society just hits you like a brick, you know, hits you right in the face from the start.
Okay.
The first 10 minutes, I believe it starts with the decapitated body. You know, it starts with a police officer
holding
up a decapitated head and, you know, throwing up the peace sign and smiling while he's getting a photograph taken. And then you get all kinds of, like, rapid succession images of, like, a child crying in an alleyway. That comes back later in the movie. But you get a butcher hacking up a pig. You get, and then from there, when they go inside of the disco club or the techno club, whatever you want to call it, when they go inside of there, we get, like, a minute and a half pretty graphic gay oral sex sequence, and followed by the guy who looks like he's probably underage, you know, even though he probably isn't, he just looks like it.
Right.
Followed by him, you know, with semen on his mouth afterwards. So the movie starts off pretty hardcore, and then from there it goes into that, you know, somebody gets their throat and wrist slashed while Tatsuhito Kibeshina, our lead character, sits there and tries to call for an ambulance with blood literally flying all over his face. And it doesn't let up either.
Right. And let's not also forget that later on in the movie there's also another interrogation sequence that involves a little of some cheap.
I'm going to be on your ass like a pear fruit of the loom.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah, that's it.
In fact, there are two such sequences, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, where basically there's people are made to give up some information by, I guess, giving up something else from
yes.
the backside. I guess he could be a little more, you know.
And what's strange about that is that they both like it, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of an odd world that Mike creates, where rape it's not necessarily a bad thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody seems to get into it. It's like the majority of the film, it's like every character, it seems like every character is either homosexual or, I mean, when you even think about it, Kibeshina, his character, you know, he's the only one who appears to be, you know, he and Takashi Caesar are the only characters that are actually heterosexual I can think of, you know, that have any kind of sexuality in the movie, but Kibeshina doesn't even, you know, choose to have vaginal intercourse,
right.
You know? Yeah, but I think Mike pretty much, the movie just seems to just paint all of sexuality as just, it's part of just this gritty, you know, almost like horrible environment that the movie takes place in, you know?
Right.
Where, you know, I don't know, it's just everything about, like, what goes on in this movie is just, it's terrifying almost, you know? Where sex and violence kind of culminate into one thing, you know?
Yeah, and actually in my review, I'm going to talk a little bit more about Mike and his violence in films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's always been kind of well known for, you know, maybe, you know, picked apart unfairly sometimes, but also there is some misogyny in his films.
Oh,
know?
Yeah, it's definitely.
And the opening to this with Kibeshina smashing that chair into the girl's face. It's like, and it goes directly, as soon as he smashes in her face, pretty much, it cuts to, you know, the titles. Boom, Shinjuku Dryad Society. It's like one of those things where you're like, boom, after the first 10 minutes, you've got all these crazy things going on, all these collages of images, and it's not quite as breathtaking or as, you know, music video-like as something like Dead or Alive, the Hanzisha, the first one. But when you get hit with that, you're like, wow, I am in a different world. I don't know what's going on here. Yeah, from there, it tones down a little bit as it goes along. But, yeah, there's tons of graphic sex and violence at every corner.
Oh, yes.
Most definitely. One thing you probably heard in the trailer earlier would be the music, which the music, I don't know, it's crazy. You know, part of me goes, oh, it sounds like you're kind of like older V-cinema stuff, you know, like the direct-to-video Japanese market, you know. Sounds like it's kind of like, you know, synthesizers, maybe a little done on the cheap. But I like it because, I don't know, it's just so pulsating and, like, rhythmic. Like, the theme that was playing in that trailer, I think, is the one that sounds a little bit more like your average, like, what people would consider, you know, sounding like Asian, maybe Chinese. I guess that would probably be to reflect the whole triad thing going on. But they got that, and then they have another theme that if you put the DVD in, if you get the Arts Magic DVD, it's on the chapter menu and everything like right. that. It sounds like something from Toe Jam and Earl, Panic on Funkatron. That's the first thing. Like, when I popped it back in, it hit me again. When I first heard it, I was like, wow, it sounds like something from freaking Toe Jam and Earl. Yeah. But,
yeah, some of the music actually kind of reminded me of music from like 48 Hours, the old Eddie Murphy movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's kind
of... It's from 1995, but yeah, that music definitely sounds like something straight out the 80s for sure.
Yeah, total, total electro pop, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Boom! But it very much fits the movie as far as, I mean, you know, that sort of music was still popular back then in the mid-90s, at least in Japan.
Yeah, in Japan, yeah. Maybe, yes. I think I like the movie, I think, mostly for, it's like, it really is probably the sleaziest cop movie I can think of off the top of my head. It takes the whole dirty, hairy type of role to a kind of a different extreme, you know, where the character of Kipe Shina, he's not a good person, really. I mean, he's not what I would consider, you know, you're not even really an anti-hero. I mean, as the movie goes along, you discover why he does the things he does between his brother and his family, and he's trying to keep them together. But the lengths and the horrible things that he does almost doesn't excuse it, you know? It really doesn't excuse it. Just like, but I like that because it's such an awkward take on the whole genre, you know? It's the anti-hero who isn't the least bit heroic, you know?
Right.
He's just kind of selfish.
Right. Well, it's just like almost what you said in your synopsis. It's very similar to like Dirty Harry, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But Harry, you know, Harry Callahan, you know, you kind of liked him at the end of the day. And Kipe Shina, you like him, but you like him almost because he's so horrible.
Right.
You know? At least that's the way it was for me.
Right.
And
sure.
The way he and his brother kind of react between each other, it's definitely, it's like an interesting little thing going on in the midst of all this chaos. I really dig where that goes, and I think it's kind of like, you know, I wrote a note, it's kind of like, you know, was it Paul Schrader's Hardcore, you know?
Right.
If you think about it in loose terms, but basically he's trying to prevent his brother, his kin, from getting lost in this, you know, reality that is not suitable for really anyone.
Right.
But the difference is that Kipe Shina is very much in touch with all of this. He's very much, you know, a part of it himself.
Right.
And he just doesn't want his brother to become that evil. But what's that?
Right. Oh, I was going to say, that's also reflected actually in their names, because I was kind of curious of, you know, I'm always kind of curious about, you know, characters' names in movies, you know, whether they relate to, you know, what their characters are actually like, you know, for example, like, you know, if someone's name is, like, let's say, Angel or, you know, Angel, I guess we would say it in American English, you know, you would expect that person to either be a reflection of what an angel is or, you know, a corruption of what an angel is. So I actually looked up their names. I looked up the kanji for their names, and I found, because, you know, with every name, there's different kanji combinations that can be used, and they're pronounced differently. And Tatsuhito, the Tatsu part in his name is actually means dragon, which, you know, as kind of like in the Western world, the Eastern world, the dragon is, you know, mysterious, also very powerful and, you know, violent. And, you know, there's the, you know, the fire, there's, you know, those kinds of metaphors. And his brother is Yoshihito, which I'm not sure if you mentioned his name, but
No, I didn't. I forgot it.
The Yoshi part in his name actually means, if I remember correctly, moral. Hmm. Or morality.
Yeah. Wow. So, that's interesting right there. Wow. that's very interesting. It kind of throws things. Basically, they couldn't be more suitable for their roles, you know? Tomorrow Taguchi, I think he deserves special mention.
Who does he play?
He plays Wong.
Oh, right.
He's one of my favorite Japanese actors. I don't know if I've ever seen a boring role that he's been in.
And actually, he appears later in the trilogy, too, right?
Oh, he's in all three of the films. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
Was he in the second one? Is he in Rainy Dog?
Yeah.
Which character
is he?
Yeah,
he's the one who's pursuing Shoei Kai.
Oh, right, the guy with the suitcases, right?
The one he's on the rooftop shouting. I mean, you just look at the trilogy. If you haven't seen the films, you watch this trilogy and you'll become a fan. Because each role, he couldn't be more different. In this one, he's basically completely and utterly insane.
Right.
He's a little bit over the top, but at the same time, he's kind of reserved with it, I think.
Well, I would say that in all three films, because, trilogy consists of Shinjuku Triad Society, Black Dog, that's a Led Zeppelin song, Rainy Dog, and Ley Lines, and they're all put out by Arts Magic, but, so Tomorrow Taguchi in the third one, he also plays somewhat of a crazy character, or at least he's supposed to be maybe mentally handicapped or something.
Yeah. I didn't understand. He seemed like either a young kid or, like you said, maybe mentally gone.
Right.
I don't know.
But all three are very physical performances, for sure.
He does a lot of roles like that, you know. I was thinking, like, even in, like, you ever heard of the... God, what was it called? I think it was Kunoichi Lady Ninja.
Yeah.
Yeah, you ever seen that?
No.
It's not really what I'd consider a very good movie.
That's why I haven't seen it.
he's in it, and he's awesome. He's got, like, I think he has, like, bleached blonde hair in it.
Oh, okay.
And, he goes over the top, but it's awesome. And women shoot lasers out of their vaginas.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a pretty good reason to check it out in the first place, but... it's also kind of lame.
Yeah, in Japan, he's kind of known, Tomorrow Taguchi, that is. He's sort of known as somewhat of like a Crispin Glover type.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
I mean, he's not actually as weird as Crispin Glover in real life, because I've seen him on variety shows before, and he's quite normal. But just the way that he can turn his character on and off so quickly, you know, sort of... you know, to me, I mean, I've seen Crispin Glover in his more serene types of moods, and you can definitely see that, you know, part of it is an act, you know, or a way to, you know, bring attention upon himself.
Takashi Caesar, I should probably mention him. He's an interesting character if you keep up with Miike's films. He's been in, I forget how many movies he's been in, probably 7 or 8, and I think all but one have all been Takashi Miike films. I suppose he must be a friend of Miike's or a friend of the family or something like that, but this is probably his best role, I would think, you know, at least the role he gets, you know, the most prominent amount of screen time with. You know.
And do you know what profession he had before he started acting?
Let me get a boxer?
Yeah.
Ah, man, that was just a guess. He just looks like
a
type.
He's a big bruiser type, right?
Yes, he is. Do you know how he and Miike got hooked up?
I'm not too sure, but I kind of remember reading that Miike, you know, Miike's from Osaka, and Osaka is kind of famous for having boxing academies, I guess. So I'm guessing Miike had some involvement. Miike, before he was a director, he was sort of a wild child, I guess you could say. And I can imagine that he probably got into that scene of, you know, like, for example, the punk rock. And boxing or fighting is also kind of part of that scene, because a lot of the wrestlers and boxers, et cetera, are sort of, you know, they're sort of misfits themselves. And, you know, they learn fighting from sometimes fighting in the streets. So I can imagine they probably met that way. Yeah.
Mikkei's films, he has a lot of a lot of his films deal with that, with like fighting and stuff as being like a way to keep in touch with youth, or like you know, just like a reminder of youth for his films,
right.
Like Osaka Tough Guys and
The Young Thug series.
Yeah, Young Thug. Right. Don't those both take place in Osaka? Am I wrong?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, I figured it did, because they both, like you were saying, with the boxing culture from that area, both films kind of reflect a little bit of that.
Right.
At least, certainly, I think the first one, Innocent Blood, if it was, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah. You can go on from there. That's about all I got.
Okay. Well, before I actually go into my review, I wanted to talk about a couple of topics, sort of the background of the film. Well, one thing is that we mentioned that this movie is part of a trilogy, and a lot of people think of this film, that is the Shinjuku Triad Society, as being Miike's first. But actually, that's not the case. It was his first theatrical movie. Before that, he had done probably about 12 or 13 V-cinema titles. And by the way, we're using this word V-cinema very loosely. That's the name of our podcast. But part of how I got the name was, of course, there's the VC is, you know, it's that acronym that comes from varied celluloid. You know, we share it with varied celluloid, which is your site, right, Josh?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And then... you know, I basically took that VC from your website, and I knew, of course, that V-cinema in Japan is an industry that's basically like the direct-to-video industry in the U.S. here, very big in the 1980s, especially when a lot of theaters in Japan were shutting down at that time because of the economy as well as lack of funding in the film industry. Anyway, so before he directed this film, Shinjuku Triad Society, he had about 12 or 13 V-cinema titles to his name, most of which I've seen, and most of which are typical V-cinema, which means typical direct-to-video, which means not really that great. I mean, you know, they're like, you know, typical Cracker Jacker type films, you know.
Come on, Silver, man. It's a great one.
Yeah, sure. Anyway.
No, it's not.
So this was actually Miike's, probably his 13th or 14th movie. And I think that kind of shows, because there is some maturity in the film that you would not see in a debut director's movie. And if you've actually seen Miike's first film, you can see that's definitely the mark of a beginning director, whereas Shinjuku Triad Society is a much more experienced Miike in terms of his vision and, you know, the technical aspects of the film. You know? Mm-hmm. Another thing I wanted to point out was the setting of the film is Shinjuku, and Shinjuku is an area of Tokyo. I happen to have lived in Shinjuku for about a year.
Oh, snap.
And I actually worked there, too. Not in the area that they were filming in. They were filming in the area that's known as West Shinjuku. And
is it really that rough over there?
That's where I was trying to bring up, was that Shinjuku, at least in the 80s, 70s, 80s, probably 60s too, so a good 30 years was the area that was known for the seedy activity in Tokyo. You know, most of Tokyo is very, it's urban, it's a mix of urban and suburban, but, you know, Shinjuku in particular is very urban. And then what's really strange is that just that area, Shinjuku, is very, it almost feels very contained, because if you go outside, like I lived in South Shinjuku, which is, of course, the southern area of Shinjuku. But once you get out of a couple blocks away from where I lived, it's all suburbs, basically, in the area that's known as Yoyogi. Famous Yoyogi Park is there. So anyway, so now Shinjuku is a little different. Shinjuku now is more of a shopping district. But what's kind of interesting is I kind of bring up this metaphor. I put this in my notes where you probably have some, or you've probably lived in a house with a backyard or a garden or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've had some, you know, for example, I have a lot of ornamental rocks in my backyard. And to me, Shinjuku is like that. On its surface, especially now, you can see it as being this nice shopping district. It's kind of, I wouldn't call it upscale, but it's up there as far as, you know, shopping districts go, I guess. But, you know, if you really look closely, you go into the areas, like I said, the western areas, it's almost like picking up that rock and flipping it over. And you know, you got all those bugs and the, you know, the worms and, you know, I guess you could call them the creepy crawlies. And that's kind of basically what Shinjuku is to me, you know. On the surface, you know, it looks decent enough, but when you actually go into the areas, especially areas like, for example, Kabukicho, which is one district of Shinjuku, that's the red light district. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, it can be a very seedy, scary area to be in. Especially at night, yeah.
Lots of rape.
Yeah.
Lots of rape and murder.
Yeah, sure.
Hey, man, I'm just going off of what Takashi Miike taught me.
Right? Okay, sure. I'm glad you chose him as a teacher.
He's a very wise man.
Yeah, I can...
What'd you say, honky sucker, pig head, jive turkey, fool?
So onward to my review. Yes. So if, actually, again, let me bring out the Japanese title of the movie, Shinjuku Kuroshakai, China Mafia Senso. Again, if you translate this literally, it means the Shinjuku Black Society, Chinese Mafia Battle, or War, actually, is the kanji. So when you hear that title, you almost think it's going to be a really epic movie as this grand title. But what's kind of interesting is the movie is actually pretty small.
Yeah.
But it's not so small that it's a character study, though. Because I would say that even though the movie does focus on Tatsuhito, the policeman, it doesn't really give him enough characterization for us to really understand his motives. We know that he's kind of above the law, or he thinks he's above the law. That, you know, he does all these kind of shady things. He has these shady dealings with people, and he gambles. He gambles on a kickboxing event, right?
Yeah.
But,
Muay Thai, I think. Yeah.
But we don't really understand exactly why he's doing these things. I mean, you know, we can understand that maybe, you know, he's got to make money. He's got parents who are sick, or his father is sick. But it still doesn't give us enough, I think, to really get a feeling for this character. So in a way, I kind of feel that it's not quite an epic movie, and yet it's not quite a small character-driven film. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, would you agree with that? I'm not too sure if you feel the same way.
I would. I would. I think for me, there's enough of his character, and I think like the scenes where like he's in the trunk, I don't want to give away too much or whatever, but he's in the trunk and he's talking to Wong and stuff like that. I think scenes like that kind of, especially as the film goes along, show enough about how much he cares about his brother and his family,
right,
and his relationship with Japan and with China. It kind of, I think it lets you get into his mind enough, but like I was saying, there's like almost no excuse for this guy,
right,
you know, no real excuse for his awful behavior,
right,
kind of thing. But yeah, I get where you're
right,
coming from.
But even with this, with that said, I think that, you know, I mentioned that the title of the movie sounds very epic, and you would think that, you know, there's going to be like thousands of yakuza versus thousands of triads, you know, all fighting together in the streets of Shinjuku. There is actually an epic feel to the movie in one way, is that you have Tatsuhito and Wang, or Wong, and to me, they, in the movie, they seem like two freight trains who are on this collision course with each other. You know, it's like, you know, there's one on one side, of course, there's one on the other side, and you just know that, you know, from almost the very first frame of the movie, that these two forces are going to meet each other, and there's going to be this big, epic showdown between these two. Which, that's the part of the movie, and I guess, you know, as far as it being epic, you know, if you want to call it epic, which I really liked, you know.
Yeah. Each character kind of, they're both kind of larger than life.
Yes,
you know?
Very much so.
And both of them are geared towards one another, right, like you say, and you know that it's not going to be pretty whenever whatever happens.
Right. And to go along with what you said about Tatsuhito being, you know, kind of that corrupt cop type. And I think you could see these two characters as being basically, you know, two sides of the, not two sides of the same coin, but the same side of the coin as far as, you know, them being both people who are so desperate and ready to do what they need to do, you know, because they want to do it. That's actually going to come up in my next point, in the film. And actually this next point, I want to debut something, a little interesting feature we have for the show. I think most podcasts have what's called a spoiler alert. A spoiler alert being a time where you want to mark when a spoiler is about the movie is going to be mentioned, so the rest of the listeners can skip that part in case they want to see the movie. Here at VCinema, well, we probably do give spoilers every once in a while and don't mark them, but we have an even more important alert that I'm going to play you right now. This, my friends, is
the pretension alert.
So when you hear this alarm, and we probably should have played this even earlier on in the episode, be prepared to hear about concepts and theories. We might mention people like Ayn Rand and Nietzsche and Freud. So in any case, when you hear this,
or not,
when you hear this alert, you may want to, if you're not interested in those sorts of topics, to go ahead and fast forward a little and go to the more bloody, interesting parts. But I did want to actually, all seriousness, all joking aside, excuse me, and back into serious mode, I did want to talk a little bit about Miike and violence. You mentioned, Josh, that, of course, Miike is known as a very violent director, and, you know, I'm definitely not going to argue that. But I think, you know, I would say, you know, of course, Miike is known for extreme violence and very, I guess you'd say, perverse violence. But I think that a lot of his violence is a little bit decontextualized. So, and by that, I mean that within Miike's world, and you mentioned, you know, Miike having his own world in his movies, I see the violence as being very contextualized in terms of, again, these characters are very, they're outlaws for one thing. I mean, even though we have Tatsuhito's acting as an authority figure, we can definitely see through his actions that he's anything but.
Yeah, and he's at odds with authority, you know, within his own department. They don't even like
exactly. him. And then, of course, you know, when we look at Wang, who's the stereotypical bad guy character, I don't want to say stereotypical, but maybe iconic bad guy character, of course, we're going to know that, you know, he's also a very desperate person. And I think that's why the violence, to me, the violence may seem extreme because I'm not, naturally, because I'm not in that world. You know, I'm here in San Francisco Bay Area, you know, in a pretty nice warm house, you know, with my computers and everything around me. And I, you know, I'm in pretty much, I guess, you know, relative lap of luxury. And that's where the violence to me is becomes decontextualized. And I think, when you look at movies like Miike's movies, I think you have to sort of remember that, yeah, they are extreme, but they're extreme because they're extreme within, you know, the world that we live in. You know, thank God we don't have to live with such extreme violence. So I say that because I think a lot of times Miike, I don't want to say he's vilified, but he kind of, Miike stands out as one of the, you know, Japanese directors who gets a lot of attention. And I think that a lot of times we give him attention because he has this, you know, he portrays this extreme violence. And I think we sort of may think of him as somewhat of a, you know, sort of like almost like a clown where we can just, you know, look to him to give us, you know, the weird violence anytime that he directs something. But, you know, especially with his new directions, you know, a lot of his newer movies are kind of moving away from that freakish violence. And I think a lot of people sort of put down his newer movies because of that. You know, it's like, where's the decapitation? Where's the waiting in a pool of feces, you know?
Beasties.
And I think that if you look at Mikkei in that way, I think it's best.
A shame.
No, I wouldn't say that. But I think it's best to sort of look at Mikkei as someone who is using, who's using, of course, like any other tool in his movies, using violence as a tool to sort of get across what his characters are about. And not like, for example, we have movies like, for example, Tokyo Gore Police, which is, you know, old wall gore. Yeah. That, mm-hmm. you know, to me, all that violence basically is very different from Mikkei's violence, right? And because that's violence just to be fun
or entertaining, yeah.
right? And Mikkei's violence is more to be, to prove a point.
Prove a point, yeah, to send something home, right. to basically help paint
the
picture.
To characterize. Or to, yeah, get, to give his characters more volume, I would say.
Yeah. Yes.
And with that said, I think that, you know, the violence in Mikkei's movies is also, to me, and I'm going to use, maybe I should play the alert again just in case. Pretension alert. So I'm going to use this analogy that I'm sure you've heard before that, you know, that film has a grammar. That film is, you know, putting out a message, and the idea that you can understand a movie on a message level means that you can understand it as being, as there being a kind of grammar that exists. So, for example, if I watch something like Up, I know that that movie is supposed to be about, one thing it's supposed to be about is keeping promises, right? So I have to understand the grammar to understand the message, right? So to me, I would say violence is the punctuation of Mikkei's movies. So you brought up a scene, for example, the scene where there's a woman, I don't remember her name, but she's being interrogated, right?
Me neither.
Yeah, thank you. She's being interrogated, and basically the end of the interrogation is that she gets slammed on the face with a metal chair. And to me, that's a strong punctuation. You know, that's like an exclamation point. It's like, bam, that's the end of the scene right there. And that's, to me, is why Mikkei's violence is so effective and why people remember it. Besides being extreme, that it's very, it punctuates his scenes very well. I mean, I can, you know, if you think of any other scenes right now, like, for example, in Ichi the Killer, let's say, you know, where, the guy, where they're struggling, and then the one guy, he has the, was it the blades on his shoes or whatever, and he kicks the guy or whatever, yeah. and then he splits in half, you know. On one hand, we could think of that as being, you know, of course, very extreme and, you know, kind of comical, actually, humorous, right? Yeah. But another thing is we could see, again, it being sort of that punctuation to the scene, you know, that's that, it's almost not even punctuation, it's almost like a punchline, I guess you could say, since it's somewhat humorous, right?
I think, yeah, like Dead or Alive, that'd probably be a pretty interesting one to look at right there. The opening, the first right. film I'm talking about, Hans Aisha, that, the opening 6-7 minutes is just it's a rock video set to, you know, extreme right. violence. And from there on, it's basically used to completely throw off
right.
the audience.
Exactly.
You know, which... It's almost like, I guess you could say, like, it's the end point of an ellipsis, you know? I mean, you sit there and you're watching this and you're just, oh my God, what's going on? But then after it's over, you hit this, you know, really plotted and not really even tense, but this really, you know, paced story,
right.
you know, right after all this collage of violence right. and insanity. And the rest of the film kind of plays out like that until you finally get to that conclusion where it picks up where it left off, but it's essentially just used to introduce you into this world of insanity
right.
and you don't know what to expect after that, and then it delivers something that you almost would have normally expected in the first
right.
place, you know? That movie to me is almost used as like it's almost a spoof.
Right, right.
You know?
But, yeah, definitely. Okay, well, I'm pretty much finished with what I have to say. You know, we have our rating system, our buy, rent, forget about it system. So what would you give Shinjuku Triad Society?
I'm definitely a buy it. even though I have recommended it to a few people, and when they did see it, it was a little too much for them. You know, it's definitely a movie with some pretty crazy stuff. There is, you know, there's rape. There are at least three scenes of homosexual oral sex that go on and on. And that can throw some people off, that, you know, they're not used to seeing something like that. So, and also that bit we talked about earlier, the second interrogation sequence.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about? A little bit of Shades of Cruising with the, you know, seen that with the cowboy with the assless chaps comes walking into the interrogation room. When I watched it, that's all I think of now. It's like, wow, it's like kind of like a reverse of Cruising. But
so that's all you think of, you say.
Okay. Thank God.
I'm going to be on your ass like a pear fruit of the loom.
Okay, I would say that Shinjuku Triad Society is more of a rental for me. The reason is because, as I mentioned, the movie title really promises this really epic film. And really, when you start watching it, you think it's a character study, but to me, it really ends up being neither. I would almost liken this film to... Have you ever seen the Pusher trilogy?
Okay. I haven't seen it yet.
I believe the director's name is Refn, but I think it's very similar. This trilogy is very similar to Miike's trilogy in that the first film has characters that are... Their characters are interesting, but they're not particularly well defined to me. They feel like characters who I know about through other films, but not necessarily through this particular film. I don't feel like I'm intimate enough with them as I feel I should be because of how the film is moving along. You know, in Refn's trilogy is very similar. The first film has characters. It's a very interesting movie, but has characters that are very traced. You don't really feel like you know them as well as you might in the other parts of the trilogy. Like, for example, in Rainy Dog. And, of course, the trilogy, when we talk about the trilogy, the Black Society trilogy, all the titles are basically, they're all movies unto themselves. They don't have any recurring characters. Yeah. But if I look at, for example, Rainy Dog and Ley Lines, the other two, I feel I know those characters, or at least understand those characters a lot more because of their treatment, the treatment given to them by Miike.
Definitely the second and third film are more, true character studies, from start to end. There's, they have their little ups and downs of anything you might expect from a Miike film if you're looking for craziness or whatever. But Shinjuku Triad Society, to me, I don't know, it's less of a character piece, even though I think there is that in there. I think, especially between Tatsuhito and his brother, I think there's a lot going on there, and I really like that. I also like Tomaro Taguchi's character, and I like how the two of them are shades of one another. And even Taguchi, even though I didn't quite pick up on it like I had hoped I would, with him constantly washing the blood off of his hands, which is a little strange little thing thrown in throughout the movie. He's sitting washing his hands, and there's obviously you can see from the distance that there's nothing there, but he sees blood, and I think he says it's the blood of his father's, and stuff like that I really like, but. I don't know, I look at it and it's almost like, almost like an action movie of sorts, but it's not action at all.
Well, I think that's the problem. I think that's why I would say it's more of a rental, because there's all these things that it's promising to be that it could be, and really what Miike delivers is something that's a little bit on the confusing side in that it's not really sure what it wants to be. I think this is part of, I would say this film is kind of the beginning of what is the Miike style that we know, is that I think that Miike really, and this is, I think, a trap that he understands that he got himself into, is that he's very much of a set piece director in this film. Basically all the scenes go from set piece to set piece to set piece. And, you know, they have their, you know, violent or interesting moments, but when they come together, I don't really feel it as being, you know, a movie that can stand up to something much stronger in his collection. You know, for example, like Bird People of China or Rainy Dog. You know, those are movies that are really, they really understand what they want to be and they really go with it, where this movie kind of feels like it wants to be a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And I think that that's part of what I was mentioning earlier, is that Miike was coming out of his V Cinema phase and going into being a theatrical director. And I think part of the V Cinema had not yet been, I guess you could say, washed out of him, or washed away. Like hands, like washing hands or something. But yeah, like washing blood off your hands. But that he was still making that transition. And I believe Rainy Dog was probably his next film. Maybe it was something else. I can't remember offhand. Maybe it was Fudo. I can't remember. But Fudo actually is kind of similar to, very V Cinema. It feels like Shinjuku Triad Society too, where it feels like he doesn't know where he wants to go. Whereas, you know, Rainy Dog definitely feels like this is my vision, you know, and, you know, here it is and enjoy it. You know, whereas I think sometimes Shinjuku feels a little bit more like, well, here's something I kind of slapped together. You know, I hope it's good.
I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, I know. That I'm probably exaggerating a little bit.
I think part of what I like so much about it is just the experience that it brings to you, you know, on top of all the little things that I like here and there. But I think, you know, it's a movie that kind of delivers, you know, sights and sounds. You know, it's kind of like just an experience to sit through. For me, it is, at least. You know, I sit there and I watch it, and I'm just, the editing, you know, just the pace of the movie to me is astounding. And then, you know, just how intense everything is. So I get on it on a more visceral level too, you know, like that. But, I can see that. And definitely, even though I'm giving it the buy, you know, like I said, it is kind of a harsh movie, you know. So it is hard to recommend straight up to people. Like, you know, you're going to love this. You know, it's definitely not that sort of a movie. You know, it's definitely something that's kind of maybe take an acquired taste, or at least a person who's a little more familiar with Miike or familiar with this style of cinema.
Okay, well, you say buy and I say rental, and
last note. I mentioned it earlier, but Sabu is who does the uncredited cameo in the movie. I forgot to mention that. For those who don't know, he's a director himself. He's been in. Was he also in Inchon?
Yes, he was.
He directed, Postman Blues, Monday, Drive, several other movies. He's an interesting filmmaker in his own right, and hopefully we'll get around to reviewing some of his stuff.
Oh, by all means, yes. Okay, well, anything else left to say?
Nope.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll go off into the blog.
Are you still looking for that special someone? Have other dating websites let you down? Hi, I'm Craig Fritz Rialdo, host of LoveFinder.com, telling you to listen to ShowShow at ShowShow.Podomatic.com. Too many websites all in one sentence? You betcha. But ShowShow is a podcast about movies for people like you who don't know what love is. Listen to ShowShow every week at ShowShow.Podomatic.com or search ShowShow, all one word, in the iTunes store.
Welcome back. Next, we're going to go into the block.
Man, we got to get some theme music.
Yeah, definitely need it. That's just not going to do.
We could beatbox.
Okay, go ahead.
Boom, tish.
What'd you say, honky sucker pig head jive turkey fool?
So the block is actually, it's a block, literally a block of three smaller segments. We have the Netflix Instant Watch, which we're going to recommend some movies that you can pull off of Netflix Instant if you happen to have that service. We have Show and Tell, and we also have the Twitter question that we put out just yesterday, and we got plenty of replies, actually. And we got one from someone who's, I guess you could say he's kind of a celebrity, which is kind of nice. We'll talk about that later. But the question was Yakuza versus Triad, who would win and why? Well, first, let's go into the Netflix Instant Watch. So, Josh, I don't know, do you think I explained that enough? Do you think there needs to be any more explanation of what the Netflix Instant Watch is?
Not really, just, you know, the Netflix Instant Watch service. You can go on there and find, you know, a list of movies that they have to stream. And, you know, I mean, some, you know, I was talking to, I think, Real Distraction yesterday. He said that the service doesn't really have too much good stuff on it, but there's actually a decent amount of really quality films on there if you really look hard enough. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of like luck of the draw, but with Criterion pumping as many movies as they've put on there, it's really just become something kind of sweet here lately.
Yeah, they put out a lot of good stuff on Instant. I'm very happy about that.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, what's your Instant Watch recommendation this episode?
All right, well, I got to go with a little old school. Orson Welles' The Trial is my pick.
Ooh, excellent.
Yeah, it's a classic. I think I discovered it through Turner Classic Movies. I don't remember how many years ago it was, but it was a few back. Even though Citizen Kane's probably the movie he'll be best remembered for, I think The Trial, from what I've watched personally, which, you know, I haven't seen all of his films yet, but it's probably the best film I think I've seen from Orson Welles. It's based off of the story by Franz Kafka. It details the story of a character called Joseph K., played by Anthony Perkins. He wakes up in his bedroom and he's being questioned by police officers. He's arrested, detained, questioned, and persecuted. And he's put on trial, and all the while, Perkins is asking, you know, what did he do? And no one will tell him. It's basically like a little condemnation of the entire justice system. And really, it's almost just like a reason for Orson Welles to just run buck wild with the camera. It's a, you know, highly visual film. It's very surreal, but it's just, you know, utterly beautiful to watch. And probably one of my favorites, you know, I've discovered in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years, I think. It really left an impression on me after the first time I watched it.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's about it. So what you got?
Well, I have a movie, actually, that I recommended on our forums recently as one of my probably the favorite movie of mine of all time. And let me just take a second before I go into the movie, actually. We do have forums, or actually Varied Celluloid has forums. You can reach them by going to the site variedcelluloid.net. We have pretty nice small community, but everyone's pretty nice. It's a pretty good discussion, and you know, there's some fun stuff on there too, which is kind of cool because it's not all just serious film nerd talk. So check us out there. There's also a link on the vCinema portal site, which you can go through. It's on the top left-hand side. It says forum. So come join us with the discussion. But anyway, back to the movie. The movie that I want to recommend is an old favorite of mine from Akira Kurosawa, 1952's Ikiru. Have you ever seen Ikiru, Josh?
I have not. But it is on my Netflix Instant Watch queue already.
You better watch it tonight, or I'll never talk to you or do another episode with you again.
Oh, Christ, I'm going to have a busy night then.
Yes. So Ikiru has been called basically the Japanese version of It's a Wonderful Life, but I think it's much more than that. Ikiru stars Kurosawa regular Takashi Shimura. He plays a bureaucrat who has basically realized that he's wasted his whole life being a bureaucrat and, you know, just basically taking care of his bureaucratic duties, and realizes that the value of life is not in doing what you're told, but in doing what's right for humanity and for, you know, I guess locally for the community. He changes his life around and is the first person who, first bureaucrat who builds this park for the city, over this land that has been a bit of a disturbance, I guess you could say, to the locals. You know, this movie, to me, I mentioned this on the forums, when I saw this movie, I think, when I first saw the movie, I was maybe 12 or 11 years old. And that was the first time in my life I remember, well, for one thing, it was the first time in my life since I was a baby that I remember really crying. And I'm maybe slightly embarrassed for saying that, but I think that shows you, you know, what power the movie had over me. And I think another thing that important that it did for me was it really, I wouldn't say at 11 or 12, but as I saw it later on in life, and I've watched it maybe about a dozen times, but it really put my life in perspective as to, you know, putting your energy and your resources into bettering, you know, both your world, because, you know, naturally, as egotistical beings, we have to make ourselves and our lives pleasurable and comfortable, but also to be able to take that energy and make others' lives also pleasurable and comfortable. So, you know, and it's not always the things about, you know, for example, donating time or money to Haiti. You know, that's very important stuff that we should be doing. But even small things like, for example, smiling to people, saying hello, you know, helping your coworker out who's, you know, stuck in the middle of something. Very easy for us to forget those things. So I thought, anyway, so Ikiru, I think, is sort of that movie that put me on the path to at least trying to do that, to trying to better myself as well as, you know, society or whatever. Sounds very grand. And I think the movie is much more grand than I actually am. So I would definitely recommend this movie, Ikiru, from 1952.
It's like an epic kind of film?
It's the interesting thing about the movie is it's very personal, but has a very epic feel to it. You know, it is very much a character study, but because of the themes that it touches on, it has a very epic human feel to it. So it's much greater than what you see on the screen.
Yeah, I've seen a number of Kurosawa's films, but that one I had never really heard a whole lot about until just recently, really. I've heard your recommendation as well as I think a couple other places have recommended to me.
Yeah. So, I think it's I think it's highly underrated. I think it mainly it's because, you know, Kurosawa, we kind of think of him as being, you know, Seven Samurai and,
yeah,
you know, the samurai and martial arts type flicks that he does. But and, you know, the flicks where he's touching on more human aspects, like, for example, The Idiot, he does a adaptation of Dostoevsky's The Idiot, which is actually not really that great. I mean, it's a little weaker. But
that was one of his earlier films, wasn't
right,
it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But those films are the ones that sometimes get overshadowed just because they're not, they don't have, I mean, I would say something like Seven Samurai is epic because it's meant to be epic. But Ikiru, for example, is epic because of what you get out of it, not necessarily what's on the screen, which is just, you know, you could just see as being, you know, oh, it's just an old man who's realizing that he screwed up his life. You know, it's more than that if you get that more out of it.
Sounds intense.
All right, so we got two movies there, Ikiru, right?
Yes, and Orson Welles' The Trial.
Yeah. So if you guys watch those movies or you have any input, let us know. We'll give you, the contact info a little later in the show.
And if you have Netflix, you have to see them.
Yes, most definitely.
Otherwise, you can't listen to any more podcasts.
Right.
Yeah.
Gee,
it's hard.
Gee, I don't think I want to watch them now. I'm just joking. So next we have our show and tell. So why don't you show and tell us what you have there, John? Let the people know. I mean, show and tell is a very common concept in North America, but maybe, you know, our listeners abroad don't know exactly what show and tell is. It might go by a different name. So explain that to us.
Yeah, basically, we're just both bringing something to the table, you know, to show off. Within our show, basically, we're picking a website or, you know, anything, you know, kind of online that we can, you know, share with the audience or share with each other. You know, just anything kind of cool or neat that we might be able to share and find awesome.
Yes.
So, my pick for this week, I'm going to go with Severed Cinema, severedcinema.com. That's Severed, like S-E-V-E-R-E-D, dash cinema, C-I-N-E-M-A.com. For those who don't know, it's a review website. They cover just, the, you know, influenced me a little bit, too, and some of the stuff that I cover. They tackle a lot of the more extreme films out there, you know. We just went from Orson Welles, now we're talking about this stuff. But, yeah.
Well, they cover, I heard like, The Trial has some disembowelments in it. Isn't that true?
Yeah, actually they do. Oh, yeah, you have to get the special uncut version.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Japanese Laserdisc. Yeah. It's got hard-coded subtitles in it and stuff.
I see.
It's amazing.
What'd you say, honky sucker, pig head, jive turkey, fool?
Please continue.
Anyway, yeah, they cover a lot of crazy films. Like, they were one of the first websites I noticed that, you know, aside, you know, I think they probably had it up before me, but, you know, the two of us were kind of, you know, VeryCelluloid.net and Severed Cinema, both Niku Durama, Daruma, that Psycho, the Snuff Reels, or Tumbling Doll of Flesh. They cover a lot of stuff like that, and, you know, the Harry Carey films, weekly, you know, women disemboweling themselves, and Stockholm Syndrome, and pretty much just a whole list of just bizarre and crazy films. They're doing, like, news and stuff now. They're covering some news items and everything like that. So, looks like they've gotten a little more active recently. So, yeah, I definitely recommend them.
Okay, well, let me share my thing. I also have a website. This website is known quite affectionately just as Yakuza Film, but I like to dub it the YMDB, which is the Yakuza movie database, if I can borrow from IMDB. But this site is located at supertony.ch, and I'll spell it for you. It's SUPERTONI.ch. So there's no com or net or org, just CH. I don't know where CH is. Maybe Czechoslovakia?
Yeah, I would.
I think there's CZ. Like or,
CZ, yeah.
Well, in any case, so.
Yes.
And actually, now that I'm recommending it, you know, coincidentally, it looks like they're trying to rebuild the site. It's actually only one page, and it only basically tells you what a Yakuza film is and has some, you know, a selected filmography. But at one time, this was probably the site to go to for Yakuza film information. They not only had the Region 1 translated stuff, but also untranslated stuff and, you know, Region 2, Region 3, all this stuff. They basically had reviews, breakdowns. They had some features on some prominent actors within the genre. And I really hope that they're rebuilding right now. So again, supertony.ch. Yeah, at the very least, keep your eyes on it, and, you know, hopefully they will regroup and rebuild the site and be able to get a whole bunch of great information on the Yakuza.
Yakuza.
Very nice.
Yakuza.
Okay, anyway, so let's move on to our Twitter question, speaking of Yakuza. Well, we've been speaking of Yakuza this whole episode.
Pretty much, yeah, in triads. Right.
And, speaking of which, our question actually was Yakuza versus Triad. Who would win and why? And I'm sure there were a lot of people who asked questions like, you mean real Yakuza? Well, anyway.
It really doesn't matter.
But just so we know, that was a question. But just so you know, the Twitter question is posted one day before we record the episode. And if you see a Twitter question, of course, you're welcome to go ahead and reply to it. And we will read your replies. That's what we're going to do in just a second. Josh, why don't you go ahead and read your replies. Who chose what?
Okay.
Wait a second, Josh.
What is it?
I want to know your opinion first.
Yakuza, all day.
Okay, why is that?
Because because they're totally awesome. Duh. that and the tattoos, man.
Okay, good.
I think it takes a hardcore man to, you know, tat up his back like that. Now, the triads, you know, I mean, if John Woo has taught anything, is that there's an unstoppable number of guys that'll come running out of, you know, a tea house or any other place to come shoot you up dead. But, you know, you don't see as many Yakuza guys dying in the movies, whereas in John Woo, you know, one guy can cut through about 500, so gotta go with the Yakuza.
Okay, that's interesting. I would actually choose the triads, because the triads are actually an older society. They have a lot of traditions. I think a lot of Yakuza traditions may have actually come from triads. I'm not absolutely sure. The triads are also known to be a lot more disciplined than the Yakuza. The Yakuza actually originally started out as kind of like, they start off as more like, the friendly thief type of characters, you know? Like Robin Hood, for example. And, you know, basically now they're kind of known as just, you know, drug peddlers, and there are actually a lot of legit Yakuza, like politicians, etc. Have very direct connections to Yakuza, and one of the biggest advertising firms in Japan is known to be at least 25% owned by the Yakuza. The triads, however, have always been very structured and very much a part of the, you know, the secret society that they're known for. So I think they're kind of more, they're still a little more mystical than the Yakuza. The Yakuza sort of have become kind of more mainstream, so.
They're the ninjas of the underworld. Yeah.
I just think they're a little more badass. So, Josh, why don't you read to us what some of the listeners answered?
Okay. _ dangerous, aka Dangerous Jamie. He wrote, "I don't know, the Yakuza would smash them all up with swords." That's a good point. Good point. They got swords, like a big dog. GGTMC wrote, "I would choose triads, but I think that Yakuza oozes coolness. The triads are just too many for the Yakuza." That's a good point. Gregory Joseph wrote, "Gotta go with the Yakuza." Metal Mikey, "I thought one of the options was one of the tripods. In that case, giant alien robots would win out."
Yeah, what was he talking about?
I have no idea.
Because I looked up tripods, and all I got was like camera tripods.
You know, I think I know what he was talking about, but I have no idea at this
point.
Well,
maybe he can write into us and let us know what he was talking about. Or call.
but really, yeah, if giant alien robots would have been thrown in, I totally think they'd win.
Okay.
But anyway. Dissolve Pet, a.k.a. Ben from Cinecultania.
Boo.
They're awesome people. Shush. He wrote, "Yakuza, because their name is secretly a word that, when spoken softly, makes heads explode. Yakuza!
You make me watch Japanese porn. I'm making you watch this Pixar film. I don't care what you say."
That's all I got. That's all I got to say about that podcast. So let me read to you who I have. Loki315, also known as Loki, said, "Yakuza for me, pinky cutting and tattoos."
Yep.
Andy NOTLP, who I also will know as the betrayer of his race, says, "My Chinese heritage compels me to say triads, but I'm going to say Yakuza. They seem more..."
So that's the secret.
"They seem more organized and calm."
Yeah, fuck you too!
Mm-hmm, John, we know what's going on now.
Yeah, he's going to get his, don't worry.
He betrayed the people.
And I got a reply actually just this morning from Miles, Miles of Shosho fame. He said, "Yakuza, I don't know why, I just want to be a part of something." Okay, well, we're a part of it now. And actually, we got a surprise reply. We got a reply from someone I guess you could say is somewhat of a celebrity. He's a journalist from out of Japan. His name is Jake Adelstein. He's written a book. The book's called Tokyo Vice, An American Reporter on the Police Beat in Japan. It just came out a couple of months ago. I actually started reading it last month, but and it's interesting so far, but I haven't finished it. But his reply, and we want to thank Jake for you know, writing into our humble podcast. His reply was, "Yakuza, not surprisingly. Yes. They are willing to die for their oyabun. A man without fear of death is hard to defeat. That's a good one. Do you know what an Oyabun is, by the way, Josh?
I have no idea.
The Oyabun is basically the godfather of the... So anyway, that's the end of our Twitter question replies. If you want to follow us on Twitter, my account is VCinemaShow, and yours, Josh, is...
At Varied Celluloid. Okay. V-A-R-I-E-D-C-E-L-L-U-L-O-I-D.
And mine is just VCinemaShow, so VCinemaShow is S-H-O-W. Follow us. We, of course, post information about the podcast. We post a Twitter question.
Nude pictures.
You do. I don't.
And videos.
Yes, and videos, I guess. That's what. So follow us, and please participate in the next Twitter question. Again, that will be posted a day or so before we record the next episode. So anything left to say for the block?
No, sir.
What'd you say, honky, sucker, pig head, jive, turkey, fool?
Okay, join us, and we'll be back with show feedback. Hey, and welcome back. This segment, we're going to be doing some show feedback. We didn't get a whole lot of feedback, unfortunately, but that's to be expected for the first episode. I mean, you know, everyone's just getting used to us and trying to figure out who the cute one is and, you know, kind of thing like that. But just to encourage you guys to contact us, we do have email. Again, I've said it a couple times, but it's vcinema@variedcelluloid.net. A little more simply, you can use vcinema@yahoo.com, too.
Whatever.
We also have voicemail. Our voicemail is 206-338-3864. If you're out of the country and you want to leave some kind of voicemail, just go ahead and record it on MP3 and email it to us. We'll be happy to play it on the show. Well, anyways, well, besides feedback and questions or whatever, we also encourage you guys to contribute. If you guys have a review of a film that we have covered or maybe a recommendation, feel free to write in, give us that. Of course, if you have feedback, if you have any promos, if you are a podcast or a blog even that has a promo, yeah, feel free to send it over to us. We'll be happy to play it for you. You know, it's nice. We like to provide for our community and everything. We did get, as I mentioned, we did get some feedback. But, you know, as I said, we only got one piece of feedback, you know, but I guess you could say that with Sour Grapes, that this is how we kind of felt about it.
It just doesn't matter if we win or we lose. It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter.
Okay, Josh, so it just doesn't matter that we won email.
It doesn't matter, man.
But go ahead and read it to us, and let's see what...
Okay. Comes from Emily, who everybody should know from Deadly Dollhouse.
Right.
.blogspot.com. She writes in, "Hey, the VJs, as I might very well start calling you, because you can't stop me. Nice work on episode 1. It was a pleasure to hear and a good omen of things to come. One thing I really enjoyed and demand more regards your familiarity with Asian cinema. As a good old dumb American, I generally get way too lazy to pay close attention to names I can't pronounce, and as a result, end up recognizing actors, sorting through alternate titles on the IMDb, getting frustrated at how many movies seem to be made in Japan, and rarely following through with putting in the work required to comb through their catalogs. I absolutely love The Happiness of the Katakuris, and was particularly taken with the performances, but have no real clue as to where to start when it comes to seeking more work from some of the cast. So yeah, help me out with that. I'm very curious to see, okay, here, how your show's format will develop. I enjoy the different sections and urge you to experiment. At this point, there are a lot of fine shows that have mastered the two-film review, so keeping it fresh can help to distinguish your style. Also, I found your quick discussion on Public Enemies intriguing. I haven't seen the film, yet, but I find that my experience with Michael Mann seems to echo your thoughts. He's a good filmmaker and a strong visual artist, but there's something so cold and empty about his work that I always feel that I I'm admiring delicate furniture displayed under grandmotherly plastic dust covers when watching his films, rather than being absorbed by a syncable couch that pulls you inside a perfectly shaped potty nook or something. Congrats and more, Emily. P.S. Brazil is too loud. Maybe I'll appreciate it more when I'm 84.
Oh, so that was that Brazil discussion you guys were talking about.
Yeah.
I see.
Yes.
Well, did you want to reply to the email first, or would you like me to go with it?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. You want to go first?
Okay, why not? So, first off, Emily, thanks for writing in, of course. The VJs, that kind of brings up some memories of MTV back when they actually played music.
Yes.
But it's also, I'm happy to be called a VJ, but I hope it's not a VJJ eventually, because I would be a little sad about that. In regards to your question about Asian cinema, I think you're going about the right way as far as, you know, looking up actors who are in particular movies and trying linking them to other films that they've been in. I would also do the same thing with directors. Directors are not the same in Asian directors, I should say, excuse me, are not the same as their North American counterparts in that they're not as stuck in a particular genre as they are here in North America. You know, I think here in North America, comedy directors tend to stick with comedy just because they know that it works for them, it makes money for them. But Asian directors tend to be a little more prolific. So you might want to start searching within the director realm and just, you know, experimenting is very important. Another thing I would really recommend is to look into the DVD labels themselves. You know, for example, the movie that we reviewed today, the Shinjuku Triad Society, was put out by Arts Magic, who's not around anymore, unfortunately, but... You know, Arts Magic being a sort of a specialty label with a Japanese genre film, those sorts of labels usually stay within their own realm. So you have people like, for example, Pink Aga here out of California, who puts out, you know, of course, Pink films. You have Tokyo Shock and, you know, other such labels who, you know, kind of try to stick within that realm because they know that there's an audience for those things. As far as really digging, though, it does help to know the languages and the names so you know how to spell them, etc. You know, you said that you liked Happiness of the Katakuris. I can imagine, you know, a film that's, or a director that's somewhat like something Happiness of the Katakuris is, which is more of a comedy. You might want to look into the movies of Juzo Itami. He's a director who is mainly known in the 80s. He was also an actor. He was in The Second Lady Snowblood. He played the magistrate in that. And he's kind of known for sort of some semi-wacky comedies. Definitely recommended. His most famous one is Tom Popo. And he's also directed The Funeral and The Taxing Woman, Taxing Woman's Return. So... Yeah, at least if you like Happiness of the Katakuris, there's another comedy to go off of. Let's see, and the last part of the email was about Michael Mann. You know, what can I say? I agree. It wasn't just with Public Enemies. I've seen all of Michael Mann's films, and for some reason I don't want to say they underwhelm me, but I think he sometimes gets a little more attention than he deserves, which is kind of odd to say because it's not like he's the most, you know, he's not like George Lucas or anything. You know, I think he's a strong director. He's definitely better than average, but, you know, I don't see him as being in that top rung of directors, at least not just yet.
Not even in America.
Right, yeah. So what do you have to say about that?
As far as the Asian film recommendations and such, well, I haven't seen it. You've seen it. Happiness of the Katakuris is actually based off of Korean film. It's a remake, right?
That's correct.
Of The Quiet Family?
Yeah, The Quiet Family.
I forget the gentleman's name, but didn't he direct Tale of Two Sisters and Good to Bad?
That's
movie?
Correct, yes. I'll look him up right
What's
now.
His name?
I'll look him up.
I forget his name, but yeah, he's a solid filmmaker, so I imagine it's probably a very good film, and I believe you said it was, didn't you?
Yeah, and there's also a Region 1 DVD out, and by the way, the director's name is Jiwoon Kim.
Okay, yeah, all right. I thought I was gonna track that one down, back when, you know, Happiness originally came out, but I just somehow got lost in the shuffle. I've been meaning to check it out for the longest, but just never got around to it. Yeah, like you were saying, you know, paying attention to directors' names and actors that you like and stuff like that is definitely really important. You know, I found a lot of, you know, really interesting movies just from looking up films that starred, you know, Tadanobu Asano. You know, just looking him up and, you know, it's like, wow, this guy was freaking awesome in this movie, so let me see what else he's done.
Right.
And, you know, found a lot of really great stuff like Sharkskin Man and Peach Hip Girl. That way. Yeah.
You know, one thing also I thought of as far as, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, but is to look up sites that specialize in Asian film. Sort of, for example, MandyApple.com, but they're also known as Snowblood Apple. They do all Asian extreme films, if that's what you're really interested in. There's also, you know, KFC Cinema, Kung Fu Cinema.
They're down. Well, I mean,
are they down right now?
I think the website's completely down. They have moved to, I forget the name of it, but some of the people who made KFC Cinema, yeah, Kung Fu Cult Cinema was the bomb back in the day.
Right.
But it's unfortunate that they kind of quit doing their thing because they were really, you know, awesome about, you know, bringing cool movies to light.
Right. And for a more artsy angle, you could always check out Midnight Eye.
Midnight Eye. They're
an excellent site.
Oh, yeah, and they get great interviews and stuff like that too. Tom Mess, is he still writing for them, or is it still his thing?
Yeah,
Tom Mess, who if you get into watching Takashi Miike films, you'll hear probably him on a commentary track or two. Plus, you know, he wrote the book, literally the book on Takashi Miike, Agitator,
right?
The cinema of Takashi Miike,
right? And there are plenty of great Asian cinema books coming out nowadays. You know, I have, for example, here, just sitting right by me, the Yakuza movie book that's written by Mark Schilling. Midnight Eye Guide to New Japanese Film by Tom Mess and Jasper Sharp. There's a whole book on Kiyoshi Kurosawa. I think all these are basically available on Stonebridge Press, if I remember. That's a book publisher that you might want to look into if you don't know it already. And one more thing, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but I do have a blog that focuses on Japanese cinema.
Yes.
And actually, I'm not saying that because I'm not saying that toot my horn just because I don't really update it very often. But it's located at gaijinzoku.blogspot.com, spelled GAIJINZOKU. And you don't necessarily have to read my posts, but I have a blog role. And I have listed plenty of Asian cinema sites and fellow blogs that, you know, you might want to check out too and read the reviews and figure out what you like.
Yeah, on the subject of Michael Mann, pretty much I agree. although Manhunter was friggin' awesome.
Yes, yes.
Manhunter was off the chain.
Yeah, that's a very, very strong film.
That's like kind of it, but yeah. That was probably his best film in my opinion, and I didn't discover it until really just like a year or so ago. But now every time I catch it on satellite, I end up watching it because it's just amazing.
Okay, well then, like once again, drop us a line at vcinema@variedcelluloid.net, vcinema@yahoo.com. Our voicemail line is 206-338-3864. Let's see, well, this is almost the end of the show, but we're going to take one more short break, and then we'll talk about what's coming up in the next episode. Well, it's the end of the show.
Hard to believe.
Yeah, I know. We've only been doing this for about 3 hours, but...
or longer.
Yeah, or longer.
Yes, it's been 3 or 4 hours, but yes.
Yeah, but of course we're having a great time talking about movies.
You're darn right.
Yeah. And we hope that you wanted to talk about movies with us. Again, email us, vcinema@variedcelluloid.net, or leave us a voicemail at 206-338-3864. For the next show, actually, I get to choose the movie this time.
What?
Yes. And I'm going to make you watch Tetsuo, the Iron Man, from 1989, directed by Shinya Tsukamoto.
Tetsuo!
No, not that one.
Kaneda!
What?
Are you finished?
No. Can I do it one more time?
Go ahead.
No. Okay. What's up?
Okay. So actually, I chose this movie because several podcasts have talked about this movie recently in passing, and there's actually been a lot of negative feedback on this movie, a lot of poor reviews. But actually, next episode, what I want to do is I actually want to argue that Tetsuo the Iron Man is not only a very good movie, it's also probably one of the most important films of the 1980s. I'll go into that in more detail next episode, so stay tuned for that. Let's see, we got the contact information, and we also have a fan site on Facebook. So if you're on Facebook by chance, go ahead and search us out. It's just VCinema. I think we should be the first result that comes up in the search.
Better be.
Yeah, I post a lot of stuff up on there, so go ahead and join us there. Go check out our portal site, that is varietcelluloid.net/vcinema.
Yeah.
Or actually, I've found out that you can also get us at vcinema.varietcelluloid.net, yes. Right?
Yep.
Very good. Okay, so you got some thank yous for us, Josh?
Yep, our friends, fans, family, etc. Starting off with Rogue Cinema. That's if you don't know Rogue Cinema, it's a monthly webzine kind of thing that I write for. Emily now, I think, is writing too. And anyway, that's Rogue Cinema. Second of all, I've got Emily at deadlydollshouse.blogspot.com. Heaven's Trash, that's In Nervous Convulsion, heavenstrash.blogspot.com, holding it down in Louisiana. Mondo Movie, another podcast, awesome people, mondomovie.com. Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, ggtmc.com, ggtmc. The Horror Geek, Mike Bracken, his website is thehorrorgeek.com. Show, they've recently switched to Libsyn now, so they're showshow.libsyn.com. Cadaver Lab at www.cadaverlab.com. Cinecultania, who, our homeboys, holding it down in the
A. More like Cinecraptania.
Oh, burn! Dude, sick.
Throwing down on you, fellas. And lady.
You make me watch Japanese porn. No, I'm making you watch this Pixar film. I don't care what you say.
Yeah, there's Cinecultania. And then Outside the Cinema at www.outsidethecinema.net.
And, of course, we're just joking around. One last thanks I want to give to is my friend Kemik. He's done the music for us, the intro and outro music. He's located at dopecomputer.blogspot.com. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in or downloading and listening to us. Episode 3 should be out within the next few weeks. I'm actually taking a vacation. I'm going to Hawaii for about a week. So we won't be recording probably for another 3 weeks or so. Again, in the meantime, though, contact us at vcinema@varietcelluloid.net, voicemail 206-338-3864. Goodbye, everyone!
Bye-bye!
Bye!
Bye-bye!